A year ago, a poll conducted by the Wall Street Journal and NBC News found that 69% of those they surveyed believe that there are still prisoners of war being held in Southeast Asia. 52% of those surveyed said they thought the government was not doing enough to get them back. Every year since 1982, the government has officially stated that it is operating on the assumption that some Americans are still held captive in Indochina. It's one of the main reasons the United States gives for refusing to normalize relations with Vietnam. Our guest this morning, H. Bruce Franklin, says that there has never been any credible evidence that any prisoners were withheld in Indochina. Further, he says right now there are no MIAs, and that extensive investigation shows that all MIAs and POWs from the Vietnam War are dead. Why then do so many Americans believe the contrary, and why does the government continue to say that there might still be prisoners being held? Those are the questions that our guest addresses in his book, MIA, or Mythmaking in America, How and Why Belief in Live POWs Has Possessed a Nation. That is the subtitle. The book is published by Lawrence Hill Books, and we'll be talking about it this morning. Our guest, Bruce Franklin, is a professor of English and American Studies at Rutgers University. He is the author or editor of 15 books on culture and history. He is one of the world's leading experts on American prison literature. He's achieved a lot of recognition also for his work in the history and literature of the Vietnam War. In addition to writing a number of books, he's published articles in a number of publications, including the Saturday Review, the Village Voice, Current, Encyclopedia Americana, the New York Times Book Review, and a number of other places. Our guest this morning, Bruce Franklin, is joining us by telephone. And as we talk, you folks who are listening should certainly feel free to call in. You got comments, questions, you can give us a call. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Professor Franklin, hello.
Hi, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. Let's start out talking about the numbers, because there is good reason for confusion and uncertainty because of the numbers that generally have been put out there on the number of Americans that are still unaccounted for from the war. The number that's generally given and that you mentioned in your book is 2,273. However, for a couple of reasons, that number is misleading. First of all, because close to half of that 2,273 are known to have been killed in action, but their bodies could not be recovered. And it was only after the war were those people, included in the POW-MIA category. Apparently, there is no doubt that these people are dead. So the question is, why is it that they are included in this number of the unaccounted for?
Right. Actually, the number is even smaller now than it was when the book came out because of the discovery and identification of several more remains. The official unaccounted for number now is 2,266, of which about 1,101 are in this official category that they call killed in action, body not recovered. And it's quite obvious that these people were put into the other total, the total of unaccounted for, in order to create the post-war issue. This happened after the Paris Peace Accords. Now, I think that there are a couple of things we really need to get very clear about here. First of all, that this category unaccounted for is one which includes this killed in action category. So the actual POW / MIA category is 1,165, and that is truly an astonishingly small number. If we compare it, say, to the Korean War, there are 8,100 unaccounted for from the Korean War, 78,750 unaccounted for from World War II. Now, in addition to that, there is the very consciously created confusion between two distinct categories, that is POW and MIA. The Nixon administration, which invented this whole issue, concocted it as a means of keeping the war going for 4 years, created this combined category. In all previous wars, POW meant people who were known or believed to be prisoners of war, and MIA meant people who simply had disappeared in some way that couldn't be explained. By putting the two together in this category with a slash mark in between, it makes it seem as though every single person who was missing from the war might very well be a POW. And in fact, today people use the term MIA when they really mean POW.
Mm-hmm. And that was a conscious move by the Nixon administration, putting those two together. And your contention that they did that intentionally to continue to justify the continued American presence in Vietnam and the continuation of the war.
Well, that was part of the engineering of this issue, and this is the I think most astonishing and revealing part of this whole story of how this was created. And a major character in this story is none other than H. Ross Perot. The story begins, I think, back in 1968 in a nation that was sick to death of the Vietnam War, that elected a man running as a peace candidate who promised that he had a secret plan to end the war as soon as he took office. And this was, of course, none other than Richard Nixon. Nixon had no intention to end the war. He intended to continue the war until its original objectives had been achieved. After all, he'd been one of the original architects of the Vietnam War back in the 1954-61 period. So the solution that he had to his problem of having somehow to deal with the explosive anti-war movement, the fact that peace negotiations were already underway in Paris, the fact that the American people as a whole recognized we couldn't win this war, was to create this issue. And it had two prongs as a strategy. The international prong was to deadlock the negotiations by making the unprecedented and truly preposterous demand that Hanoi and the southern insurgents release all American POWs as a precondition for our agreeing to discuss the terms for ending the war. Normally, of course, warring nations release the prisoners after the end of the war, not as a precondition to discussing how to end the war. But, and this is the really ingenious and audacious thing where Perot came in, on the domestic front, the strategy was to convince millions and millions of Americans that somehow, by not doing this, Hanoi was holding our prisoners as, these are three key terms, hostages, ransom, and bargaining chips. And these were the terms that were later to be the foundation of the post-war POW myth. Perot's role was to orchestrate a media blitz to convince the American people that the POWs were hostages, ransom, and bargaining chips, and also to quarterback the campaign in Congress, which he did. It was one of the very interesting aspects of this story in light of the recent developments, is to watch this guy who now is presenting himself as a Washington insider masterfully conduct Congress through its various paces in this campaign. And it was extremely successful campaign. By the end of the war, there were 50 million POW bumper stickers. There was the bracelet campaign. Mrs. Perot was the first one to wear a bracelet. There were 135 million postage stamps. And in fact, by the end of the war, there was a significant number of Americans who believed that we had gotten into the war to rescue our prisoners of war.
Hmm. It's the Perot connection is also interesting because it doesn't seem to want to go away. Recently there were some pieces in the New York Times about how as recently as 1986, I believe, Perot testified before Congress and was still advocating a commission be set up to look at all the information talk about recovering POWs. And in fact, there was a story apparently circulating that he has not formally denied, that though the story is circulating that he offered the government of Vietnam to actually buy back prisoners. He was going to write a check for some amount to get these people back. And as recently as 1986, he apparently, allegedly, was talking about doing that.
Well, actually, in March 87, Perot went to Hanoi, and now you get two contradictory versions of this, as you do with everything involving Perot. He was evidently, I tend to believe this part of it, acting as the unofficial emissary of the Reagan administration and negotiating with Hanoi about POWs. However, when he was in Hanoi, he started making a number of statements, which he then went on with after he got back, which infuriated the Reagan administration, which was using this issue for its own political agenda. He had a different one. And his activities around POWs, of course, didn't cease in 87. He has become a kind of heroic figure in the POW-MIA movement. And as a result, the POW-MIA activist organizations, which are quite formidable, are working now as a kind of core infrastructure for his presidential candidacy.
Hmm. Well, are there other ways in which he benefited from his has benefited from his involvement in this issue?
Well, certainly didn't hurt him with the Nixon administration, because in the very period when Perot was serving as the orchestrator of the media and congressional campaign, the Nixon administration was interceding on behalf of EDS in order to get more government contracts from a variety of government agencies, and also the Nixon administration interceded on behalf of EDS with the Internal Revenue Service. So I don't speculate about what his innermost motives may or may not be, but certainly this was a very beneficial thing for him. He was, before being called upon by the Nixon administration, a director of the Richard M. Nixon Foundation and a major contributor to Nixon's candidacy.
Our guest this morning is Bruce Franklin. He's a professor of English and American Studies at Rutgers University. We're talking about his book, MIA, or Mythmaking in America, subtitled How and Why Belief in Live POWs Has Possessed a Nation. He makes the argument in this book that in spite of the fact that there's a lot of evidence to show that there are no living POWs in Indochina from the Vietnam War, that a great many Americans continue to believe that they are. So the question is why. If you have questions, comments, you can give us a call, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Just, I have a caller, and I don't want to get to that person, but let me just ask one further question, and that is, if in fact one could understand the motivation of the Nixon administration in continuing to talk about POWs there and continuing the war, then one has to ask, well, why, when the war ended, did we still keep talking about it? And in fact, now, all of these years later, why it is that the Bush administration, the Reagan administration, the Carter administration, the Ford administration continued to operate as, with this assumption that there might still be people there in the face of all of the evidence that says there aren't?
Well, the answer to the question partly derives from the fact that the war didn't end, that the war simply assumed another form, that Vietnam is still defined legally as an enemy nation. If you want to travel there, you've got to steer around the Trading with the Enemy Act provisions. The United States has been waging ferocious economic and political warfare against Vietnam ever since the formal end of the war, with quite profound effects on Vietnam. Vietnam is absolutely cut off from international funds that are necessary for any third world nation, especially one that was devastated by decades of war. In fact, if you take a larger view, I think it becomes clear that our nation has been waging hostilities in one form or another against Vietnam ever since 1946, 8 years, of course, as the main backer of the French. The secret war began in 1954. The overt war began, depending on how you count, in either 63 or 65. And then since the end of the war, which was either in the Paris Accords in January 73 or the fall of Saigon in 75, as economic and political warfare, and ever since the formal end of the war, there has been only one issue that has spanned the gamut of this period, and that is the POW issue. It is the only outstanding issue which is used today to legitimize U.S. hostility against Vietnam.
Well, let's talk with some callers. Going first to our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Yes, Professor Bruce Franklin? Yes, sir?
Yes.
Well, the U.S. government has been waging not only ferocious war, as you call it, against Vietnam, but, of course, against Cuba for over 30 years, you know, due to the total blockade of trade down there. But I want to say that the extreme right wing is really waging a big political campaign to try and exploit the so-called POW-MIA issue. Are you familiar at all with Radio Free America, what it is?
Somewhat, yes.
Well, if you have access to a short wave, now you're in the east, right?
Right.
Okay, then in your time zone, they're on from 10 to midnight. If you could ever spare the time, tune in, because this so-called Tom Valentine, the so-called talk show host of that, that's one of the big issues around which he broadcasts, and he's had on a Bo Greitz. Do you know who Bo Greitz is?
Yeah, well, Bo Greitz is a major character in my book. I've also,
that's right.
I've also debated with him.
Yes, that's right.
Bo Greitz is the model for all those POW-MIA rescue movies that began in 1983.
Yes. Right. He's claimed he's made several trips, if not into Vietnam itself, of course, quite near the border.
Into Laos, yeah.
Yeah, and he comes back with all this information, supposedly, that he has contacts, that native Vietnamese have told him that they've seen prisoners and they know where they're being held, and he's going to somehow, it's all going to be spread out in the media very dramatically quite soon, but we never hear it come out.
Well, all these scam artists share that. I mean, they've all been making promises for many years that they're just about to bring out live POWs.
Yeah.
Bo Greitz, after his first raids, which began in November 82 and went on into January 83, which is a very interesting story about the coordination with the Reagan White House on that, testified to Congress that he had 30 rolls of film taken with these super high-tech cameras, and which he promised to turn over to Congress, and they kept asking for the 30 rolls. They never appeared. After those first raids, he claimed that he'd brought out the remains of two American men. They were subjected to scientific tests, and they turned out to be pig bones. And this is pretty characteristic of most of these scam artists who've been preying on the families and preying on the American people and, of course, doing a tremendous amount of damage to the people of Indochina.
Yes, well, I do want to say...
I do want to comment on your first point, which
right.
is a very important one,
yeah.
not to let that slide by. And that is, I mean, when you get right down to it, and I think it's a response to the question that David asked a few moments ago, the real motivation for conducting this warfare against Vietnam is precisely the same as the motivation for conducting the economic and political warfare against Cuba, which has nothing whatsoever to do with POWs. I mean, obviously they don't claim that there are POWs in the case of Cuba. But the POW issue, because it turned out to be such a powerful, emotional issue, has served as a way of building really strong support for the continuing hostilities against Vietnam, so much so that it is turned into something which I argue in the book approaches a national religion.
Yes, yes, sir. Well, of course, you may be excuse me. You may be aware that the so-called spotlight newspaper of Washington D.C., that extreme right-wing
mm-hmm.
Weekly paper, pays for the radio program, the Radio Free America program, as they call it. And I feel that the Spotlight and the Radio Free America radio program is just exploiting the emotions of all these poor, hapless families, you know, raising their expectations.
Oh, very much.
Yes. And I think it's a terrible situation what they're doing.
Right. I mean, the families certainly are the main victims because, as I'm sure everybody realizes, when you lose a loved one, it's necessary for human beings to complete a process of grieving and come to some kind of closure. And what this issue does is make it impossible for the family members to do that. They can't complete that process of grieving. The wounds are constantly being reopened.
Let's take another caller. We have somebody on our line number one. Hello. Oh,
yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. Last year I read in the New York Times, it was about a paragraph long, that one or two Frenchmen had come out of China for money, of course. And they had been in Vietnam. They were prisoners. And I didn't see any more about that in the paper.
I think I remember the particular small stories that you saw. I mean, this has been a recurring part of the myth.
You mean that was untrue?
Right. There's a whole pseudo-history which substantiates the belief in live POWs. And part of that pseudo-history is that the Vietnamese held large numbers of French prisoners of war after the Geneva Accords of 1954.
Why would they hold them? Why wouldn't they sell them off to China or Cambodia or someplace like that?
They didn't. And this was first alleged by none other than Nixon himself, and as soon as he alleged it, the French government denied it. And he alleged it again. They denied it again. I have many documents directly from the French government denying this. Now, what they did was, as very typical here, is distorted a lot of facts and preyed on people's ignorance of the actual history of the war. Because, in fact, the Vietnamese turned back to France all the French prisoners that they had held. But they did not turn back to France many of the people who they had captured who were in the French forces, and there are very good reasons for that. One, over half their prisoners were Vietnamese, so they weren't going to return them to the French. The second group consisted of Germans, of people who had been in the Nazi army, who had been captured at the end of World War II or surrendered at the end of World War II and forced into the French Foreign Legion. Whole units of the French Union forces in Vietnam were German-speaking. Now, those men were not repatriated to France. They were repatriated under international auspices to Germany. And the third group consisted of French colonials, especially people from Senegal, Morocco, and Algeria, who did not want to be repatriated to France. Remember, 1954,
yeah,
the year that the French surrendered in Indochina, was the same year that the Algerian Revolution broke out. So those people wanted to be returned to their own country. Then there was one other category, that is, there were 38 French soldiers who decided to stay there, to decide of their own free will to stay on. A number of them had married Vietnamese women and so on. And those 38 came back later when they made the decision to return, and most of them were court-martialed.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do have, what was it, Private Garwood.
Yeah,
Garwood.
Exactly parallel.
He maintains that he wanted to get out. He couldn't get our embassy to help him.
Yeah, well, the Garwood case is really quite revealing because Garwood has been turned into a kind of hero by the POW movement.
Yes, I noticed that.
He's a very strange hero indeed. Garwood
he survived.
Right, Garwood went over to the other side and was guarding American prisoners. He had a Kalashnikov assault rifle. He said he told the other prisoners.
I think that's how he survived.
Right, he told the other prisoners that he was an officer on the other side's army, and he decided to stay. There was no doubt that he was there. I mean, the investigations that were conducted after the war indicated that. Pentagon officials testified that he was there. So there was no question about that.
I think the government just wanted him to evaporate.
Well, when he came out in 79, he said on national television on more than one occasion that he hadn't seen any other American in 12 years. Then later, after he was court-martialed and convicted on seven counts of collaborating with the enemy, Gaurav Wood began to change his story because he had fallen very much under the influence of Dermot Foley, an attorney who was part of this right-wing ideological group that had taken over the National League of Families, and Donna Long, another right-wing POW activist, and began to talk about all the Americans who were still there. But this was a very recent invention on his part.
Well, once Kissinger, you know, talked about paying Vietnam, and it was categorized as war reparations, and I was opposed to that in 73, but I think that I should have been more intelligent to see that perhaps we should have paid it, the $2 billion or $4 billion that they wanted, and we would have maybe had an end to this.
Okay, well, that's a very important part of the story also. It was a codicil to the Paris Peace Accords, and it wasn't, you know, some vague promise. It was an official pledge, and the monies were specified. And the story of how that came out is very fascinating and revealing. In the years right after the war, the most ardent proponent in Congress of the idea that they were still alive POWs in Indochina was a conservative congressman from Mississippi named Sonny Montgomery. Montgomery convinced the House of Representatives to set up a select committee, make him the chair, and investigate this. They conducted 15 months of investigation. Quite excellent. Much better than the present Senate Select Committee's investigation, in fact. They determined a number of things. They determined that there were no prisoners of war. They determined that there could never be a full accounting. There never had been in any previous war. They determined that there was one prisoner who had been a prisoner who was still alive in Vietnam. That was Robert Garwood. And they began to get inklings that there was something along the lines of this secret pledge that had been made. So State Department officials testified to this committee under oath that no such document existed, no such pledge had been made. But when members of the committee went to Hanoi in 1975, the Hanoi government gave them a copy of this document. I actually print the document as an appendix in the book. And this was a letter sent from Richard Nixon to Phan Van Dong, the Prime Minister of North Vietnam, the Hanoi government, pledging $3.5 billion worth of aid for the rebuilding of the country. Now, again, there have been these strange twists of logic that have occurred in the POW movement, that somehow people believe that this pledge of aid and the fact that the U.S. reneged on it is the supposed reason that Vietnam would hold prisoners. But actually, the opposite was the case. That is, that the Nixon administration began to leak the idea that Vietnam was holding prisoners as a way to wriggle out of the pledge that Nixon had made to Hanoi. That was how this originally emerged, and that's very well documented in my book.
This morning we're speaking with Bruce Franklin. He is a professor of English and American Studies at Rutgers University. He has written books on a number of subjects dealing with culture and history. Among other things, he is known for his work in the history and literature of the Vietnam War, and is the author of a recently published book entitled Mythmaking in America, or Mythmaking in America, about how and why people continue to believe that there are live prisoners of war continued to be held in Indochina from the Vietnam War. Lawrence Hill Books is a publisher of the book, if you'd like to look at it. And we have certainly room for many questions. You want to call us locally, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is, again, on our toll-free line, so we'll go right to them. Hello.
Well, good morning, Mr. Franklin.
Yes.
Why is it that we went to war when Charles de Gaulle of France said, you cannot win a war, we were there for 12 years, and we haven't accomplished anything. We spent billions of dollars and thousands of lives. We still have cripples in this country from the war for nothing.
Well, certainly the war not only was a disaster, an ongoing disaster for Indochina, but it's still really a disaster for the United States in many ways. I mean, there's still many, many victims of the war in the United States. And in fact, when we say that the war isn't over, I think the war isn't over inside our country as well. I mean, it's extremely divisive. And in fact, it's pathological. It's interesting when you think about it, what President Bush said during the Gulf War. He said, well, finally, we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome. That's very strange language, you know, kicked syndrome. What's he talking about, an addiction, a disease? And in a way, it is. And this issue is the main form that the disease now takes. I mean, clearly, the motivation for getting into that war was something that no administration in Washington could be honest about with the American people. If they'd been honest with the American people, we never would have supported going in the first place. It had to be done behind our backs, and then it had to be justified for all kinds of spurious reasons, decade after decade.
Was that a defense contractor's war?
Well, I don't think that's the main motive. I mean, I think if we're going to use the right word, some people may not like the word, but it's the accurate word. What we're talking about is imperialism. I mean, that U.S. motives of being there were not fundamentally different from French motives. The French were there to preserve their colonial empire. The United States was there to develop a neo-colonial empire. And I think that any other understanding leads to confusion and illusions. The notion of the quagmire and the mistakes and so forth is not accurate.
Is there oil there?
I'm sorry?
Is there oil there?
Yes, there is oil there. I don't think that it was well known at the time. Ironically, today, one of the forces that's actually moving behind the scenes, putting pressure on to normalize relations with Vietnam, are some of the large oil companies, because they're are rather frustrated by the fact that the Japanese, the French, and the Italians are in there getting oil right now.
I read an article.
Eisenhower said that the reason that we wouldn't allow the free elections that were specified in the 1954 Geneva Accord was because Ho Chi Minh would win the election, would get 80% or more of the vote, and what we needed the tin, tungsten, rubber, and bauxite. I think that's a rather simplistic view, but there's an element of truth to it.
I read an article, though it's been at least 10 years ago, that the oil reserves in Vietnam are greater than there are in the Mideast, that all the known reserves, it would be like a postage stamp on an elephant compared to Vietnam.
Well, I think that's pretty speculative myself, but certainly there is interest in it. But you know, during the war, Vietnam was already serving as a pool of cheap labor. U.S. corporations set up factories in ringing Saigon, making electronics components, making clothing. People were getting 75 cents to a dollar a day. You know, it was good business.
All right, thank you.
All right. I'm still, Professor Franklin, I guess I'm still sort of puzzled about what, as far as the government today is concerned, what is the status of these unaccounted for people? And it's my understanding, and after having looked at your book, that after the war, all of those, and in the first few years after the war, all of those people who were ever listed as possible prisoners by the Pentagon were either released or were presumed to be dead. And that at this point, the government is only listing one person officially as a POW, and this is somebody that we have good evidence to believe is also dead.
This is Charles Shelton.
Charles Shelton.
Yeah. Well, actually, at the end of the war, although there was this combined category POW/MIA, really internally, the government, of course, kept separate lists, and they had a list of people they believed were prisoners of war. When the Vietnamese released their list, it turned out that they actually released or accounted for more rather than fewer people carried on the internal lists of the Pentagon and the State Department. However, there were 56 so-called discrepancy cases, that is 56 particular cases of men that the Pentagon and State Department claimed might have been prisoners who were not accounted for or released. That was reduced to 54 and then 53. When the Montgomery Committee asked the Pentagon and State Department to produce these cases, it turned out there were really only 36. And of the 36, there was the possibility of only between 11 and 14 having been captured. That the others, there was just no evidence that they could have been captured. And yes, it's true that now officially there's been a presumption of death for everybody except this one who's carried for symbolic purposes. But the government, I mean, the government's position is, it's really an indefensible position. The government's position is, maybe there are live POWs there, maybe they're not, we don't really know, we're doing our best to find out, and meanwhile we're going to base official government policy on the assumption that there are live POWs. Now, this is one area where I find myself in complete agreement with the people who are the strongest believers on the other side, and that is, if there are any live POWs, there's no way that the government couldn't know they're there. With a combination of aerial surveillance, satellite surveillance, we have an enormous intelligence infrastructure on the ground. We have interrogated tens of thousands of refugees from all those countries, including defectors from high-level military and intelligence circles. The government knows for sure whether or not there are any live POWs there. And people on the other side of this issue then go on and conclude that the government must be engaged in an elaborate conspiracy to hide the existence of POWs and then go through all kinds of tortured and illogical logic to support that conclusion. I think it's much simpler and more straightforward than that. The government wants an issue to legitimize continued hostilities against Vietnam, and so keeps the issue alive. And, of course, it has, in the meantime, turned into something of a Frankenstein's monster.
Let's take another caller here, again on the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Were you on WGN about 2 weeks ago with a man named Donovan or Donahue?
It was longer ago than that. It was back in March, I think. Right.
Okay. Now, he frequently mentioned two men who were on an outpost on Guam who interpreted a code.
Minarson and Mooney.
Okay. Would you go over that?
Yeah, well, this is one of the more bizarre stories that has been revitalized by the Senate Select Committee by allowing testimony from them. These were Army sergeants who were assigned to NSA, National Security Agency, and one of them, and then substantiated by the other, backed up by the other, claims that he somehow had broken the code that the Vietnamese were using in their radio transmissions that referred to American prisoners. And so by keeping tabs on these various code words that he said he claims he understood, these were in Vietnamese and these were on open radio frequencies, which is really bizarre, he said that he was certain that there were hundreds of POWs that were kept and many were sent to the Soviet Union and so on and so on. I mean, it's a totally preposterous and bizarre story, but it is widely believed by people in the POW/MIA activist circles.
Okay. And then in about 1980, when Reagan was running against Carter, I remember watching a woman from representing POW groups, and she despised Carter. I mean, it was unbelievably obvious the degree to which she despised him. And did groups feel that they were not treated fairly by Carter, or why were they so anti-Carter?
Well, this involves partly the history of the National League of Families, which was formed with the active assistance of the Nixon administration in 1969-1970. Was a very strong supporter of Nixon's policies, but then began to split into pro-war and anti-war groups in 1971-72. After the war, the National League of Families was taken over by extreme right-wing group that was using this for their own political agenda. There was a meeting in Omaha in 1974, which these people took it over. And during the Ford and Carter administrations, the National League was an oppositional group which argued that these administrations were betraying the men, betraying the families, and so on. When Reagan came in, things really switched dramatically because Reagan himself had been involved with the POW issue for a long time. In fact, ever since he had been an actual prisoner of war as the hero of the 1954 movie POW. And in 1983, Reagan actually brought the National League of Families into the government, into the decision-making of the government, when he declared it was the now, quote, the highest national priority, unquote. Then at this point, the sort of thing that you observed in 1980, which was coming largely from the National League of Families, the baton was now passed to groups way out to the right of them, which now see the National League of Families as some kind of government stooge and sellouts on this issue. So that we've had this constant drift to more and more extremism on the issue. But the beef that they had with Carter was that Carter, for a while, was suggesting the possibility of normalizing relations with Vietnam prior to 78. He did a 180-degree turn in 1978 when the Carter administration came to the conclusion that China was a whole lot more important than Vietnam.
Okay, do I have time for one more?
Sure.
Okay, I heard an ex-military person talking about that there might be a financial advantage to being a POW as opposed to, like, missing or declared dead, that families get, like, the medical benefits as if the person was serving. Is that true?
And pay. Now, I mean, this is a more complex issue than it appears, and there's a whole gender question that eventually gets involved. You have to understand that 81% of the missing were flight officers, and, you know, I speak as an ex-flight officer myself. I flew in the Strategic Air Command. But, I mean, it's not like a ground unit. The men who are flying are all very close social associates and often friends of each other, and their wives are close social associates and friends. It is the squadron commander who makes the determination when a plane is lost whether the man or men on that plane are MIA, missing in action, or KIA, killed in action. Many squadron commanders decided they didn't want to determine that he was killed because, for one thing, it meant on a personal level telling the wife of a friend of their own wife, your husband's dead. It also meant depriving her of all these benefits. Now, the gender question comes in when you realize that most of these wives were fairly young women who could have had some other life. And what this decision was doing, made from a very male point of view, was making these women permanently the wives of dead men. So in 1973, 74, and 75, many wives actually went to court in order to have their husbands declared dead so that they could get on with some other life, at which point some really ugly things came out. I mean, in contradictions among family members, sometimes with parents saying to wives, well, it's a lot easier to get a new husband than it is to get a new son.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We do have a couple of minutes left. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the conduct of the government of Vietnam, whether we can say that they have been completely forthcoming with any information that they had about the fate of people who were missing in action, who were presumed dead. I mean, how well have they done in turning over anything that they had to the U.S. government?
Well, extraordinarily well, considering the situation. I mean, considering the fact that the government was still waging economic and political warfare against them. I mean, they've been very, very forthcoming. That's varied in different periods. They have turned over hundreds of remains. They have now given us access to large parts of their own military archives. We have teams wandering around in Vietnam digging for remains. The Vietnamese government has one overriding motive in all this. I mean, they want normal relations with the United States. They want the United States to stop vetoing all the development funds from the international banks and so on. So, I mean, the idea that they were holding POWs is really preposterous when you look at what motivates Vietnamese foreign policy. I mean, this would be absolutely counter to their aims. And one of the surprising things, when Perot visited Vietnam in March 87, I guess he'd never heard the Vietnamese side before, which he started repeating. He pointed out, this is one of the things that got him in trouble with the Reagan administration, Perot pointed out that many people on the village level in Vietnam were very upset with their government for spending so much time dealing with American MIAs when Vietnam has hundreds of thousands of their own MIAs.
Well, I'm curious about your reaction to some of the stories that were in the news. I guess it was last year there was a lot of coverage of a photograph that had been released purporting to show three pilots, I think, who had been shot down in Indochina, that was widely circulated. I'm sure people saw it. And then there also was General Kalugin, this former KGB officer, who made some news talking about the fact that he Soviet officials had interrogated American prisoners after the time that Vietnam had said that they had let them go. Your reaction to those two stories?
Well, first of all, the picture you mentioned, which is the one most people have seen, is supposedly Lundy Robertson Stevens. That's been proven to be the product of a notorious band of scam artists operating out of Cambodia and Thailand. There have been several other pictures which have all been proved to be absolutely bogus, phony pictures of Daniel Bohr, Donald Carr, and so on. The general you speak of is ex-KGB General Oleg Kalugin, who had told a variety of stories, which he then said were based on information he had gotten from another KGB officer named Oleg Nechiporenko. Nechiporenko denied all of this, said that, yes, he had interrogated one American POW and only one, and that was before the end of the war. Kalugin himself eventually retracted most of the stories attributed to him in a letter published in the New York Times on January 25th of this year. Very few people have seen that retraction. I mean, it did not get the kind of play in the news that the original bizarre stories had, any more than we found out in major television news that that photo of last summer had been exposed as a complete phony.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. We're here at the end of the time. I want to thank you very much for taking the time and talking with us today.
Thank you, David.
Our guest, Bruce Franklin, is a professor of English and American Studies at Rutgers University. If you'd like to read more, his book is entitled MIA or Mythmaking in America, and it is published by Lawrence Hill Books.